A report out today reveals the extent of damage that's been done to Australia's ecosystems, and it points to farming as a major cause. The WWF report finds that half of the ecosystems across the continent are threatened, and a new criteria set out by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. The report uses 40 years of satellite imagery and land use maps to look at how native wildlife has declined. Dr. Martin Taylor is the report author. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's been known for quite some time that large areas of Australia's land is degraded, and also that species loss is a serious problem. So what does this report tell us that we didn't already know?
I think the new message here is just assessing the extent of ecosystem endangerment. So that's quite different from, example, just an area cleared. So you can say so much has been cleared. But what's been the consequence in terms of putting ecosystems on the edge? I think that's what's new about this report. We've only got indicative figures, but the indicative figures are not very encouraging.
Mm. So when you say an ecosystem is threatened, what does that actually mean?
Okay, well, we have to use proxies for ecosystems. It's not possible at that scale to get a fine analysis of every single ecosystem, but we just looked at vegetation groups and intersected with the subregions that have been mapped for Australia. So two systems of vegetation mapped by subregions, sub-bioregions, I should add. Let's call these proxies for terrestrial ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. So what, you look at the type of plants and type of animals in a certain area and that defines an ecosystem?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one first pass, of course. If you really want a detailed analysis, you have to go and look at all the animals. This is just based on vegetation.
Yeah, okay. And so what, there's about 12,000 in Australia, is that right?
There's about, if you map it this way, there's about 5,815 ecosystems that we've mapped. Nearly half, so about 48%, meet one or other of the criteria that the IUCN have developed recently for being considered threatened in some way.
Okay. Why is that figure so much different than the national assessment that says 66 ecosystems are recognised under national legislation as being at threat?
Well, it's a very different process, basically. The national process is very different. It's not terribly different from the way Queensland does it. And actually, this whole report was inspired by the way that Queensland both maps and assesses the conservation status of ecosystems. We didn't get a terribly different result from what Queensland. In fact, we got smaller proportions than what Queensland does with their more detailed mapping and assessments.
Mm-hmm. So how surprised or how bad is the news, really? It's when you say nearly half of Australia's ecosystems are at threat, it sounds awful. Is it as bad as it sounds?
Oh, I think it is, yeah, and we see that with the massive declines, the number of threatened species we have. We definitely see the result. I mean, so many, like Northern Hairy-Nosed Wombat, one good example, it's down to about 126 individuals. Used to range from Victoria up to central Queensland in the semi-arid woodlands. We've only got 126. This is the largest burrowing herbivore in the world. Very iconic species. We've only got 126 individuals left.
Okay, so that's just an example of...
Just one of many, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's two hotspots in particular that you've identified. Where are those?
That's in reef catchments, so the Great Barrier Reef catchments, and also southwest corner of Western Australia. These are hotspots in terms of where ecosystems have become endangered or more endangered as a result of land clearing since 1972. So the figure of 1972, of course, is based on when Landsat satellites started giving us information.
So why are those areas, those regions in particular, why have they seen so much damage?
Oh, I think it's because of the large post-war expansion, particularly into marginal country, the clearance of the Brigalow, which was, of course, actively pursued by successive state governments in Queensland. So there's been a whole process of governments actually actively promoting land clearing, and we see the result of that now, particularly in the post-war period in those hotspots.
Mm, all the governments, I guess, promoted that so that we'd have an agricultural industry.
Well, yes. But we could have had an agricultural industry that actually was far more conservative in terms of sending ecosystems to towards extinction. So, yeah, it could have been done differently.
Mm, I guess the benefit of hindsight, though.
Benefit of hindsight, yeah.
Yeah. You're hearing here from Dr. Martin Taylor, author of a WWF report released today, Changing Land Use to Save Australian Wildlife. Extensive report that points out about half of the ecosystems around Australia are threatened. This is using the criteria of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Now, also with me is Dennis Saunders. Dennis is a retired CSIRO research scientist. Dennis, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, this report, the Carnaby Cockatoo, is on the front cover of this report. You've been following the fortunes of that species for a long time. Does its fortunes mirror what Martin explained?
Oh, indeed, indeed. When I went to Western Australia in 1968 to work on what was then the white-tailed black cockatoo, it was vermin with a bounty on its bill. By the mid-1980s, it was on the World Endangered Species List, and it's now about to be... Its listing may change recently, in the near future, to critically endangered.
Mm. So what's happening? What's going on for carnivores?
Well, it was straight habitat loss, Cameron. When I went west in those days, they were releasing 1 million acres of land a year, you know, over 400,000 hectares of land a year under a conditional purchase, and the conditions under which you purchased it were you had to clear it and you had to fence it, and if you didn't do both fast enough, you lost the land. And there was no guidance given to farmers about how much vegetation to leave on the land to prevent some of the environmental tragedies that we're now trying to deal with, like salinity in the past, which is going to come back to bite us again, and the loss of our absolutely magnificent biota.
So, as you've heard from Martin there, it's land clearing and that land clearing associated with agriculture that's highlighted in this report as a major cause to the problem, just like the situation in WA you outlined there. Do you point the finger at farmers, though, or do you feel like they were just part of an industry doing what they were basically encouraged to do by governments?
Well, no. This is not a blame game. I think we've got to be quite clear about this. Farmers did precisely what the society and the governments through then of the day said. We want you to produce food and fibre. We want you to do it as efficiently as you can. And here's the land. We're giving you it under conditional purchase. No guidance was given to them about what sort of clearing patterns to engage in. And all through this, there were some clear-sighted, long-sighted farmers who thought, no, this could end up with a lot of problems, and you will find that some farmers throughout that period have been trying to work out how to farm in a conservation-friendly, if you like, manner to basically build a sustainable industry, but without sacrificing any further of our unique flora and fauna. Mm. And there are some wonderful examples around this country of these people.
But would you say they have been in the minority? First and foremost, they were about producing food and fibre?
Yeah, look, certainly they're in the minority, but don't forget that society is now changing and saying, conservation is a big issue. We want farmers to conserve our biota, and I think this is where we've got to be very clear in our minds about what we expect of land managers, because when you come down to it, who manages the land? It's the farmers. They want to have a viable industry. They want to have a viable property to hand on to their offspring. They want not to degrade the landscape. And what we need to do is to work out how do we work a system that gives them the incentives to do what society expects them over and above in terms of stewardship. You know, if, for example, and use my black cockatoos as an example, most of the areas where I know they breed is on private property. If we expect farmers to also produce black cockatoos, what sort of incentives should we be giving them to make sure that they are doing that?
And so you're talking economic incentives, basically paying farmers to do this work?
Yeah, I'm saying that at the moment, if you look at the Martin's just given a pretty graphic account of what sort of damage has been done to our ecosystems, if you think about this in terms of an environmental subsidy into our production of food, fibre and water, how do we work out how those subsidies are actually paid? Mm. And somewhere along the line, the consumer will have to foot the bill.
There's some suggestions in this report, the WWF report, that points to, say, a certified sustainable agriculture system that then shoppers can choose to buy, and some of that money goes towards paying farmers for their conservation work. There's also this idea of reforming the tax system, so there's economic incentives there for farmers that look look after the land. Some of those suggestions are quite similar to what we heard from the Wentworth Group just last week. They had a similar report out as well that pointed to a change in the tax system so that there could be economic incentives for farmers to, whether it's plant trees or whatever it might be. Is that something you think farmers would take to, would be interested in if those reforms took place?
Yeah, just as a, just to point out that I'm also a member of the Wentworth Group, so I'm familiar with that report, and I was party to the writing of that report. But yes, look, somehow along the line we've got to make sure that the resources are available to meet these sorts of commitments. Look, we're a wealthy country. There is no reason why we can't work on some system. But it shouldn't really be a subsidy system. It should be a fair and transparent system so society knows how much it's paying for conservation and farmers have a reasonable expectation that conservation is a product of their farming activities as well as food and fibre.
So you're just talking about including the environment and the environmental cost of food production in the overall market, in the economic system?
Indeed. Why shouldn't we? Why should we not reflect the damage or the remediation of that damage? If you basically say, look, we can produce food and fibre, but to hell with the environment, someone else is going to have to fix it up later, that is a massive subsidy that's going to be borne by future generations, and that's quite frankly is not fair.
You're hearing there from Dennis Saunders, who's a retired CSIRO research scientist. Now, let's go to Borowa now, near Yass in southern New South Wales. It's, you might call it a typical farming landscape. There's tree cover has been replaced by broad-scale farming and agriculture. David Marsh is one farmer there who's been trying to reverse the environmental degradation over the years. David, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tell me what you do on your property to try to minimise your environmental footprint.
Well, we probably have a few things that we think about. It's a bit of a mind thing for a start for us, and some very important principles that we like to look at. How does the landscape function in a natural way? And generally, for 3.5 billion years of life, communities of organisms have contrived to be more elaborate and diverse over time. And when you go farming, you divert a lot of energy away from ecosystems towards ourselves, and that causes simplification of ecosystems. So it's no surprise that diversity gradually goes down with farming systems.
Mm. So however, why did you go down this path, though? What is it that motivated you to follow this type of farming, sustainable farming, if you call it that?
I was a conventional farmer splashing lots of money and products around on our farm for two-thirds of my farming life. But towards the end of that period, I started to have feelings of disquiet about some of the things that we were having to do to try and make a profit out of agriculture. And I just started to worry about whether what we were trying to do was going to be something that would be a long-lasting way of behaving on the landscape. We tended to have, and I think many farmers are in this position, an economic relationship with the land when it's actually It needs to be much more than that. It obviously there's a social question. People are living on the land, but there's also the landscape itself, which is if we don't allow it to be complex and resilient over time, then agricultural industries they'll really suffer. And you can see that happening now. I think the costs of running current industrial farming systems are incredibly high because energy costs are going up. And in a simplified landscape, you can do nothing but keep on throwing money in to try and get a yield.
So that's the situation now. But over the journey, has it cost you in an economic sense to make the decisions you have?
Well, we started out, I suppose I could talk about a few things we've done. In the past, we recognised we had about 3% tree cover on this property. It was heavily cleared, like most land around here. We noticed trees dying back in the 70s, so we started planting trees. Now we've got about 17% tree cover on the place, so came at a reasonable cost, but it was a cost that we were prepared to bear because we felt it was an ethical thing to do. It was as much for our own future as for those who come after us.
But what about when it comes to say, not just the cost of putting trees in, but maybe the amount of stock you run or the crop you plant?
Sure. No, look, I don't think it hasn't affected our how much livestock we can run, for example, on the place. What we're doing with grazing now, it's another step ahead, really, compared to just planting trees, which were an important part of the landscape. But now with the way we're planting our grazing, that allows a lot more species to come into the system at no cost. So that's an allowing way of behaving, where you're tapping into the natural processes of life at no cost or low cost. So it might mean that your income might be slightly more modest, but you avoid these great pitfalls of debt when you get into a series of drought years, and you may not get the highs of a boom year, but you'll have a very even income, and you're much more likely to make a profit because your costs are so low.
So overall, there's upside to the economics of this. You come out in front, are you arguing?
I think that it's an absolute imperative. If you don't have an improving ecosystem on your farm, your farm's going to be very expensive to run over time.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, when you talk to WA farmers who have a similar philosophy, have they reached the same conclusion that over time they might come out in front in a financial sense?
I certainly know farmers who basically say, look, we could run our properties at maximum economic return, but it will be an environmental cost. If we actually take a conservation approach, and there is one extremely good farmer that I know in the Central Wheat Belt who takes that approach, and she has said, and she's an economist actually, she did economics at the University of WA and then took over the family farm. She said, I know I'm running the property at not the maximum output in terms of financial output, but I know it's what is going to be a sustainable return over the long term. And I won't lose my Major Mitchell cockatoos or my red-tailed black cockatoos. And I will take that as part of my farming activities, will be protect those particular species. Mm.
But then I guess farming is no different to any other industry. There's people that want a return now and they want it quick and they want the best money they can get as quickly as they can. David, if we saw some of the changes that are raised both by the Wentworth Group last week and in this WWF report today, and there was some kind of tax reform, so if you whether it was your income was tax deductible due to environmental work that you'd done on the property, or if there was some kind of stewardship fund through reform to taxation, then farmers were paid as a result of work. Do you think it would convince others who have not been inclined to change their practices to date to maybe go down a path similar to yours?
It's a really tough question to answer. I think you're talking about when you look at change, and it's the same in any facet of human life, I think, is that if you want change, it's incredibly hard to get people to shift from the status quo. But if you're asking people to behave in a way on the landscape over and above their ethical stewardship obligations, then I think it's absolutely important that there is a broad scheme that the whole of society contributes to. The whole of society has created, have been willing participants in the running down of diversity in the landscape in Australia. One of the measurements of the consequences of our behaviour is that a lot of our soils have lost 70% of their organic carbon. Now that's like the bank in the soil, and we've been running it slowly backwards. So what we do when we behave like that, and nobody knew it was even happening until recently, but what we do is we say we make money from agriculture, and we call the income, we call the money that we get that leads to loss of diversity, we call that income, but in actual fact it's liquidation of natural capital. So it's a complex question, but points I want to make that both Dennis and the other fellow mentioned was that we hear a lot about this word sustainability, and people like me and lots of others who think like me have shifted away from the word sustainability, because if you're sustaining something that's already damaged, it's not really good enough. We're beginning to talk all the time about regenerative practice. So it is possible to behave in the landscape in a way that's going to allow diversity to return to landscapes, It's economically viable, but it's very low cost. So regenerative behaviour is possible, and in fact, it's actually necessary. And there are lots of farmers who are doing those sorts of practices, but it's not really recognised by government too well. It's a marginal activity, but it's an incredibly important activity that we certainly should be indulging in more.
David Marsh, who you're hearing from there, a farmer near Yass in New South Wales. You've also been hearing from Dennis Saunders, who's a retired CSIRO research scientist. We're discussing the fact that today the WWF has released a report called Changing Land Use to Save Australian Wildlife, and it points out just how severe ecosystem degradation has been around Australia and the role of conventional agriculture has had in this and land clearing that's been associated with farming. The author of the report is Dr. Martin Taylor. Martin, what do you actually want the federal government to do?
Oh, I think the government can do a number of really important things. The first, of course, is legislation. We've had a situation where governments have actively promoted land clearing, and of course we've had overclearing as a result, as, for example, David's discovered on his property, where he's actually been putting vegetation back into the landscape. There's got to be rules that apply to everybody. Otherwise, you know, there will be people who'll take advantage of the situation and be spinning a short-term profit, but degrading the environment in the process. So rules are, you know, a bottom standard is necessary. And I think the next thing, of course, is protected areas. There's going to be areas that are very important for biodiversity, and the government should be stepping forward to either secure those areas or actually paying the farmers to put a covenant over areas that are important for biodiversity. I think the last thing is certified sustainable agriculture. At the moment, people like David can do amazing work, but where's the reward for them in the marketplace? Can they take what they're doing to restore the landscape and restore biodiversity and restore soil condition? Can they take that to the marketplace and get rewarded? And that's what we think is a very important role for government, to support that type of reward system in the marketplaces, the marketplace.
And it's, as I said earlier, an idea that seems to be endorsed by the Wentworth Group as well in a report released last week by that group. But Martin, thank you. We'll make sure we link to the report via the Bush Telegraph webpage. It's extensive, almost 100-page report, and we'll link to the Wentworth Group report from last week as well so people can follow their interests there. Just go to RN Bush Telegraph in your search engine, and those links will be up this afternoon. Dr. Martin Taylor, my thanks to you, the author of the report Changing Land Use to Save Australian Wildlife. My thanks also to David Marsh, farmer near Yass in New South Wales, and Dennis Saunders, who's a retired CSIRO research scientist. You're listening to Bush Telegraph.